From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Stephen Quayle joins us. The oil spill, Bigfoot and Giants, all in that order, but here's what's happening. Police officers in a very small Arizona border city are on heightened alert tonight following a tip that a Mexican drug cartel will put them in its crosshairs if they conduct off-duty busts. The threat stems from a marijuana seizure made this month by two off-duty police officers riding on horseback in an unincorporated area there east of Nogales, a city of roughly 20,000. Jerome Corsi, he watches the battle to secure America's borders, his book, Minutemen. Jerry, this is a serious situation, and I'm told by some people in law enforcement that it's bigger than the mainstream media is reporting. Is that true?
It's true, George, and the reports that we're getting now out of Nogales that, in fact, police are being targeted for assassination, sniper attacks by the drug cartels is very alarming. I watched the news broadcast from Nogales on the Internet, police chief just saying that they have credible reports that their police officers who were involved in drug busts have now been targeted, named, and are being hunted even off duty by the drug cartels from Mexico.
Well, Jerry, what are we doing about it? How come we're not sending troops down there to protect these law enforcement officers?
Well, it is a disgrace. The federal government, the Obama administration, needs to take seriously the infiltration of drug cartel operatives. There's also reports there in the hills around Tucson, spotters from the drug cartels that are watching law enforcement, spotters that are hiding out in the hills around Tucson being supplied by the drug cartels. If we're letting the drug war spill from Mexico into the United States in Arizona and actually now presenting a threat of assassination to law enforcement officers in Arizona, we can't ignore this any longer. This is an invasion and an armed invasion by drug cartels that control Mexico and are now making a stand in the United States.
Doesn't this also tell you that the war on drugs just isn't working?
There's no question, George. The war on drugs is a complete failure. We have not been able to stop the flow of drugs. If anything, the drug cartels in Mexico are getting stronger. Open borders are a clear cause of the problem. But I think we've got to take seriously a look at our drug laws and evaluate whether or not this attempt to prohibit drugs is really just giving a business opportunity to the drug cartels in Mexico.
Jerry writes for WorldNet Daily, very accomplished author. Jerry, keep in touch.
Thank you, George.
The Iranian officials are continuing to offer their oil workers to us to help prevent this disaster of the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. That's right, I said the Iranians, the Deepwater Horizon rig that caught fire and sank last month about 50 miles off the coast of Louisiana, took 11 people with it. Haidar Bathmi, the managing director of the National Iranian Drill Company, said his company's ready to help out and contain the spill. He says our oil industry experts in the field of drilling can contain the rig leakage in the Gulf of Mexico and prevent this disaster in that part of the world. But nobody's taking him up on it. A federal judge struck down the Obama administration's six-month ban on deepwater oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico as rash and heavy-handed, saying the government simply assumed that because one rig exploded, the others pose an imminent danger, too. And the White House has promised an immediate appeal in a moment. David Bloom joins us. We'll get his reaction to this story for the hour. Authorities conducted door-to-door searches Tuesday after a warning siren failed before a tornado touched down in Eagle, Wisconsin, damaging or destroying at least 125 homes and injuring one person. That's got to be frightening. Are the toys in your child's Happy Meal making him fat? Well, the Center for Science and the Public Interest says yes. The Washington-based consumer advocacy group threatened to file a lawsuit against McDonald's, charging that the fast food chain unfairly and deceptively markets the toys to children. Bill Wagoner has been in the internet marketing business for 16 years. Bill, let me ask you this first of all, as the devil's advocate. What's wrong with marketing to children?
What's wrong with marketing to children? Absolutely. Well, nothing except for the fact that as long as it's not hurtful to them, I mean, that's the issue, right? They're claiming that it's hurtful to the child's well-being, the child's health, the boy or girl's health. There's nothing wrong with marketing to children. I mean, the parent is the one that makes the decision, right?
That's right. And the kid's not eating the toy. He's eating the hamburgers and the food.
Right. Right. You know, it's another case of one of these deals where, you know, money talks, and they know by suing an organization like McDonald's is where they'll cave an extra another $25 million in their war chest so they can go out there and just bring out more things. Why don't we sue Subway? Why don't we sue everybody? I mean, you know, goodness gracious. Let's sue Toys R Us, too. Oh, yeah. Toys R Us. How about that?
Toys R Us. I've got my own problems with fast foods, you know, and whether they're healthy or not. For me, I won't eat fast foods anymore. I stopped about a year and a half ago. But for parents, you know, if they want to start raising their kids and feeding them, you know, nutritional food, you know what? They got to sit down with them and say, you know what? I'll get you this little toy, but not there.
Yeah, or just say, you know, you can say no, can't you? You can go right through Ronald McDonald's deal and say, hey, you know, well, this time I'm not going to get the toy. It's very simple. I mean, the only thing you do is just say it. You know, my daughter, I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she asks me all the time, daddy, 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 you know, but the toys are you know, they go everywhere, though. They're every place. So if this lawsuit goes through and they win, it opens up the gate for all of these other kind of attorneys that just, we call them ambulance chasing attorneys, to just go after everybody. Is it the job of the parent, or is it the job of the government? Or I think it's the job of the parent, personally.
I think so, too. Bill's website, 888freedom.com, part of our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Russian mathematician Vladimir Arnold is dead at the age of 72. Now, you don't know who he is, but his work is considered indispensable to other sciences, and his rewards include having an asteroid named after him. He pioneered work in the field known as catastrophe theory, and his work on the CAM, K-A-M theory, led to a better understanding of the motion of planets in the solar system and the host of other applications. He died in Paris, again, at the age of 72. Michael Jackson's estate has made more than $1 billion since his death. And can you believe it? A year ago already. Jackson's album sales have generated about $383 million, while revenue from the film This Is It has hit nearly $700 million. The anniversary date of his death is June 25th. We will put, by the way, a link up of a 9-minute movie produced by former Cleveland Sun newspaper executive and continuing film critic John Urbancic to look at the coasttocoastam.com website on Thursday. It has to do with the afterlife and Michael Jackson. It's only 9 minutes. It's kind of neat to look at. I've been looking at it all day today. Up next, David Bloom joins us. We'll talk about the deep water drilling, the ban, and what's next for us on Coast to Coast AM. David Bloom is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture. He is the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas and a leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. Here he is on Coast to Coast this hour. Hey, David, what's new with you? Where have you been?
Oh, heck, George, I actually took a vacation. I don't even know. I couldn't even remember how to spell it, but I did get away to Idaho and was going down the Salmon River. And, gosh, I think I avoided the radio for a whole 4 days. And, oh, my God, when I came back, what a mess.
Oh, it still hasn't stopped yet. You know that, David. It's still going. My gosh, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do? Gosh, well, you know, it's like there are so many choices about what to do. It's hard to even figure out where to go. But I think one of the things we have to do right away is, you know, regain our sovereignty here in America. I mean, these, you know, we've been talking about the rule of law here for the last 10 years, you know, pretty seriously since 9/11 and who knows what else. And yet here we are, you know, looking at companies that think that their company name, BP, means beyond prosecution.
Yeah.
You know, and that, you know, that, well, you know, I like the idea that the Iranians want to come over and help us because, you know, British Petroleum used to be British Iranian petroleum.
That's right.
Originally,
very long time ago.
You know, before they lost their hold there in Iran. So I imagine these guys actually trained the Iranians in how to work with oil. So you know, maybe some of that expertise rubbed off. But I got to say that what we're looking at here is you know, basically corporations running amok and telling governments what to do. And that's what I mean by regaining our sovereignty here. When we look at what the you know, the billionaire pirates are doing down there in the Gulf, it just boggles the mind how they'll tell us things day after day and then have to amend them and increase them every other day. I mean, now we're up to, in the last couple of days, they say, oh, by the way, you know, we told you that cutting off the pipe, you know, to try to relieve the kink and pressure would maybe increase the oil 20%. Well, now the experts say it doubled the output of the well, at least. And of course, in a few more days, it'll double again. We're probably looking at, by today, a quarter billion gallons of oil spread across the Gulf. And it's
not the 127 million they say that's out there.
No, but you know, there's a huge incentive to keep the number down, because when I say the rule of law, what I'm talking about is the thing that's lurking in the closet that BP doesn't want us to look at, which is we have a law about this. If you discharge recklessly this oil into the waters around the United States, you get fined. It's the rule of law.
Yeah.
So we're talking about, you know, somewhere out there in terms of $4,300 a barrel if they get tagged for the whole thing. Well, BP's, you know, book value has gone down to less than $100 billion. And, you know, that still sounds like a lot of money until you add up these fines times the amount of oil. And by Christmas, we could be talking about fines that are greater than the entire value of BP to the stockholders.
Oh, no, that's true. Let's talk a little bit about this judge who lifted the offshore drilling ban. He apparently, in his 2008 financial disclosure report, shows some holdings in 8 petroleum companies.
That's right.
Or funds that invest in them.
That's right. Yeah. Although it looked like a minor amount by the time people looked at it currently of only maybe $15,000, it's not clear just how large his holdings were before that. You know, that just reminds me of how in California we have the California Air Resources Board. These are the people that are supposed to regulate the emissions from people like oil companies and utility companies and cars and all of that. Well, it turned out our head of the California Air Resources Board had to step down as it became disclosed that all her personal wealth was in oil, natural gas, and nuclear power. So, you know, we've had the foxes in the hen house before, and I'm afraid this pretty outrageous ruling that allows the, you know, the bloody politics of oil to go back into action even before a mere six-month pause to see what we really ought to be doing here.
You know, David, as we look at this situation since the explosion of April 20th, and of course you've been a guest with me way before that, as we talked about your work, alcohol can be a gas, which sold like hotcakes, as a matter of fact,
yeah.
After we did that program. You
it
know,
still stuns me, George.
It would be great to say, let's convert today and change and all that, but you know, realistically, that's not going to happen yet.
Well, gosh, what's realistic here, George? You know, if you take a look at the Energy Information Agency, the people who track, you know, energy around the world, they say that we get about 200,000 barrels a day from offshore wells in the United States. That's all of them, you know, thousands of wells. I think in the Gulf alone, there's maybe 3,600 wells that are active. And of course, then there's California, and you know, so.
And I see them. I see them along the coast of California.
Yeah, you just look out in Santa Barbara Channel, and there they are.
Yeah.
So we're looking at, you know, a lot of oil, we think, 200,000 barrels per day. But, you know, the alcohol industry in the United States, you know, the folks that make alcohol from corn and from wheat and from cheese whey and soda pop syrup and all these different things we ferment, make alcohol that we can use for fuel, we make 600,000 barrels a day.
Wow.
We're already making 3 times what they're making offshore from oil. And if we want to replace that little drop that comes from our offshore oil now, little 200,000 barrels a day, all we'd have to do is turn on the reserve capacity of the current alcohol plants that are sitting idle because oil companies refuse to buy the alcohol to mix with their gasoline.
Do you find that more and more people are beginning to make their own types of fuel with the machines that you've talked about in alcohol can be a gas? Is that growing?
Absolutely. And over the last 2 months since the Gulf disaster, we are getting inundated by people who, are saying, I can't stand putting that stuff in my car anymore, and I'm finally going to do it. Yeah, so oil is not very expensive right now, but I'm going to start making my own moonshine and put it in my car. This year.
And explain, by the way, what you meant by moonshine.
Well, yeah.
Where's your place, David?
Well, moonshine is, of course, ethyl alcohol or whiskey or the stuff we drink. So you often hear it referred to in the press as ethanol, which sounds like kind of a mysterious chemical, but it's actually average everyday sipping liquor. Now, of course, it's stronger. It's essentially pure alcohol, 200 proof, or the way we make it at home, 192 proof, or
Jeez.
Almost pure. And that's what we're using to run cars. And Brazil, of course, runs getting up close to 90% of its cars on pure alcohol now. And in the United States, we make billions of gallons of alcohol a year that we mostly mix with gasoline to reduce emissions from gasoline because alcohol is really clean.
That's right.
But, this year at the Midwest Renewable Energy Fair up in Wisconsin, there were several of my students who had read Alcohol Can Be a Gas that had different distilleries they had built and were demonstrating them and putting it in their car, which they converted, and it was quite a statement about, a different way to go. There were plenty of companies, of course, with Priuses and with hybrid cars and, the new electric car, but those were all made by factories and corporations. There was a real outpouring of people up there at the thing, just hovering around all the booths where people were making their own fuel right there at the fair and pouring it in the car.
Do you need to have a license or permit to do this?
Well, you do, but luckily it's a very simple permit. It's only 2 pages long, and basically it asks you where you have your distillery. Do you have a fence up around your yard so someone doesn't sneak in at night and try to drink your fuel and things like that? And so it's a very simple permit. It's free, and it allows you to make up to 5,000 gallons of fuel a year. And that's, pretty much the amount that BP said it was spilling per day when this thing got started.
That is something that people should try.
Well, it's the thing about it is, there's a lot of dispute about, and you and I have talked about this, whether we're talking about, oil running out, or whether there's abiotic oil that is produced at a regular rate down in the earth. But one thing we know, to get either an abiotic oil, or if there is an abiotic oil, whatever oil is left, it's down deep, or it's in a place that's hard to get at, like under the Arctic ice cap, or, in places that we wouldn't have gone after it before because, that's the expensive stuff. Why not? Why go after that? We can, just get under the sand and in OPEC countries and not have to go so deep and under easily working conditions. And so, that easy to get at oil, as Matt Simmons points out, that's what we've peaked in.
I get it. An email every once in a while from a guy who just goes ballistic every time I talk about the abiotic oil theory. And that theory, of course, being that this planet has an abundance of oil. It was basically here when the planet formed. And, and it just is here. It's not from dinosaurs and plants. And he just goes nuts whenever I bring it up, David. You're at least open to the possibility that it could happen, right?
Well, I have troubles with the theory, too. But I think where you and I agree, George, no matter where the oil comes from, whether it's abiotic or whether it came from old algae that got squished, whatever it comes from, we know we can't be burning it. It's the wrong stuff.
Yeah, I don't have an argument with you there.
Yeah, and so it doesn't matter to me whether it's abiotic or biotic, because the point is that the stuff that's coming up out of the ocean and up out of the seafloor, natural gas and horribly toxic chemicals, which, go under the general name crude oil, we can't have that around where people live. And it's taken us 100 years to figure that out, and this is a really bad way to learn it, with this blowout in the Gulf. But, you know, if we're lucky, I'm right, and it's not abiotic oil, and it'll wind down, and we'll be able to do something about it.
Yes, it hasn't yet, David.
I know. And or if you're right, George, we're looking at this problem for a really long time.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, one of the reasons why the big oil companies don't want to tell us that it's abiotic, according to me, is that it would then be very cheap, and they want to keep the price up. We'll be back in a moment with David Bloom. We'll take your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Stephen Quayle joins us as we talk about world matters, Bigfoot, and giants. We've got it all for you tonight on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back, we'll take your phone calls with David Bloom right here on Coast to Coast AM. David, would you say the production of alcohol fuel has gone up over the last 5 years? Is it flat? Where does it stand?
Oh, no. It's alcohol fuel around the world has been dramatically increasing. Virtually every country in the world now is building plants to produce alcohol because, well, you know, economically, it just beats the heck out of, you know, any of the ways we're going to produce fossil fuels nowadays. I mean, this oil from the Gulf of Mexico, even if they could somehow actually pump this stuff, you know, when you're dealing with thousands of pounds of pressure per square inch and $500 million drill rigs and, you know, that is not going to be cheap oil. And so you're looking at ultimately $100, $150 a barrel, which they're going to have to get us to pay for.
Yeah.
But alcohol, heck, you can make that for $20, $30, $40, $50 a barrel, depending on what you start with. And the rest of the world is going there. Sweden expects to be completely off of fossil fuels and onto alcohol within the next 4 years. Ford just went to, in this country and around the world, is now selling its heavy-duty line of trucks with an optional alcohol engine. They're offering to give us one to work with this year. So that's, you know, the 250, the 350, the 450, the 5. I mean, all the working trucks that Ford makes now have alcohol fuel options.
I know over a year ago we talked about how many of these alcohol fuel stations are out there. Is that growing at all?
Oh, tremendously. We're talking to a company in California right now, Propel, that's planning to build 200 more stations over the next couple of years. And there's now well over 2,000 alcohol stations around the country. You know, I drove a Ford truck from their factory to California last year, and we got the whole way there without ever buying gasoline. We were able to hopscotch from one alcohol station to another all the way across Highway 80 to San Francisco. So, you know, alcohol is coming. The oil companies are terrified. And that's why what's going on right now is a full court press to try to discredit alcohol. Because, as I mentioned earlier, we can actually replace all the offshore oil with just lifting our little finger in the alcohol, you know, industry to replace that amount of oil that is very expensive coming from offshore.
That's an interesting thought, too. Let's go to first-time caller Jewel. Driving around in Louisiana. Hello, Jewel. Go ahead.
Mr. Bloom, can you hear me, sir?
Yep.
Bet, Jewel.
Okay. Mr. Lurie, I don't know if this has got anything to do with what you're talking about tonight, but I tried to call you last night when Captain Kelly Sweeney was on, so I finally got through tonight. Can you tell me anything about the natural gas bubble that he talked about last week?
All right, that was from Richard Hoagland, who says that in the water, underneath, that there's this huge, massive gas bubble that could create a major problem. I don't know if you've heard of that, David.
I have, and I've looked into it. So, you know, basically, when you get below about 15,000 feet below the surface of where you drill, a lot of the oil gets very hot from all that pressure and breaks down into natural gas. So that makes a tremendously high-pressure situation, just like, say, if you boil water in a pressure cooker and of course, the expanding water makes the pressure go up. So there's some worry, you know, among some people that the natural gas coming out of this well might be in the many tens of thousands of PSI from all this buildup of pressure, and that it might actually be raising some of the rock strata underneath the floor of the ocean. I've talked with oceanographers who are pretty familiar with what's going on, and they're actually down there working in the Gulf now, and they say that they're not seeing any evidence of that, but what they are seeing is what you and I talked about, George, 3-4 weeks ago, where what's going on is that the well casing is split somewhere, and the natural gas and oil are escaping out the side of the well and working its way through all the fractures in the rock, and coming up from the ocean floor. And this Matt Simmons was using his connections to say that's probably 4 or 5 miles away from the wellhead, and none of that film that BP has of it is being given to the government. So although it's a frightening scenario that you could have a Krakatoa-type explosion on the bottom of the ocean from the natural gas, and then, of course, the natural gas exploding when it reaches a pilot light at shore, it looks to me like right now we're just seeing a lot of oil and natural gas come up through the floor but not causing any kind of seismic disturbance. But, gosh, you never know what happens if they drill 2 or 3 more wells into this gas pocket and it starts to all work its way through the ocean floor. So I don't think it's out of the question we could have that kind of problem. But in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, I talk about problems like this with methane hydrates, which until this film people didn't know about, which is basically natural gas that's frozen into ice and in the depths of the ocean. And there are huge deposits of that, you know, under a few hundred feet of mud all over the world. And there are people like BP that talk about drilling into these mountains of slushy mush to extract the natural gas. And you can see through 4 miles of rock what happens with this pressurized gas when it gets loose. Just imagine if you start mucking around with drills through mud into the top of basically snow cone mountains of this methane hydrate just to get a little natural gas. So what I'm trying to tell you there is that our pursuit of fossil fuels is leading us to do crazy things, like with tar sands in Canada, methane hydrates at the bottom of the ocean, and now we've got, you know, the BP geyser coming out from, you know, some enormous deposit into the ocean. And all this is in pursuit of a fuel that we can't even safely burn in our atmosphere. We have to get away from this kind of fixation on fossil fuels, and that's why entrepreneurs across this country are looking at making alcohol and taking on the oil companies in their communities and underselling them.
Steve from California writes, what happens if this spill remains unchecked for 6 months to a year?
Well, oceanographers have talked a lot about this, and I've done a bit of study on it. What we're looking at is that water from the Gulf, and you know we predicted this and it's already happened, reaches the bottom of Florida. It gets, you know, it leaves the Gulf current, gets picked up by the Gulf Stream, heads right on up the east coast of the United States, you know, basically up to as far as North Carolina, maybe Washington, D.C. And then it starts to head across the Atlantic and ends up in Europe. So, you know, we're talking about this spill, the toxicity of this spill, literally being spread in a circle eventually up the east coast, across the ocean to the Atlantic, and down the Atlantic to Africa. That's the ultimate worst case scenario. You got to remember, a very tiny amount of this oil is incredibly toxic. One drop on an egg in a marsh in Louisiana is enough to kill the animal inside that egg, whether it's a gator or it's a bird.
See, that's going to be the problem.
Yeah, it's the toxicity.
The cutting down of the breeding. I mean, it's a planet killer.
Well, let's hope it's not a planet killer. But, you know, there are bacteria that eat it, but, you know, that's a problem. Because in the process of bacteria eating the methane clouds that are, you know, down 1,000, 2,000 feet in the water, and the dispersed oil, those bacteria eating it just like it's food breathe just like you and I do, and they use up the oxygen in the water and breathe out carbon dioxide just like you and I do. So all the fish and the shrimp and the clams and the mussels that need to breathe air also, because those are animals, won't have any. And so you're talking about basically asphyxiating the entire Gulf. Now, maybe that's not a planet killer, but we're talking about billions and billions of dollars worth of food that people ought to be able to eat. Now, you know, the oil companies go on about food versus fuel with alcohol, like, oh my God, you know, we can't go ahead and process the starch and corn to make alcohol because, you know, we might starve somebody who would be eating the corn if that, you know, somebody had 4 legs and big eyes and was a cow, of course. But here we are, food versus fuel. We're talking billions and billions of dollars worth of seafood that people in the United States will not get to eat because of oil. So there's real food versus fuel issues right there.
Let's go back to Columbus, Ohio now. Chris, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi, Chris. Go ahead.
Yes, George, I have like a 2-part question.
Sure.
One, I want to ask David if, since I have a 2001 S10 and I have flex fuel, would it work with the alcohol? The other thing I want to mention was watch Anderson 360 on TV, the CNN, and he brought up about the Atlantis rig that doesn't even have the plans, the engineering plans that they wanted to shut it down. It's four times the size of this one and four times as deep, and they don't even know how to shut it down if they had to. And that story's been kind of blown away by the news media, not even been touched. But, yeah, I want to ask about the flex fuel and if you'd heard about that, Atlantis.
Well, that's great that you've got a flex fuel S10. Flex fuel means that your truck was made at the factory to be able to run on any amount of alcohol or gasoline, and there are millions of those trucks on the road. I've got an old Ford Ranger, for instance, about your vintage, a 2000, and it was made in 2000 to run on both alcohol and gas. In fact, U.S. has been making these things all the way back to 94. But if you want to have that kind of flexibility, be able to run on any amount of alcohol or gasoline, there are aftermarket kits like the one that we put together and sell, and it makes your car pretty much just like a flex fuel from the factory, where it can say, oh, you know, you got 20% alcohol in the tank because you had gas before and now you're putting in alcohol. Well, fine, we can burn that too. So,
have you heard the Atlantis story, though? Atlantis rig story, oil rig?
Well, I've been hearing rumors about that one, but, you know, the whole point of this, the problems with this technology is no one is expecting to have to pump this stuff for very long. Now, you know, that may not be true. You know, there might be way more oil than they think down there, and actually these rigs might be in place for a long time, and now safety becomes really important,
yeah,
or in the case of an accident like this. But, again, we don't need the oil. We can replace it. In fact, right now we got thousands of rigs in the Gulf. If we just spread nets from those 600-700, we got about 10,000 miles of spill right now, and so I want to back up.
And by the way, the Atlantis rig is what, about 150 miles off of New Orleans? I think it is.
And it's already tapped? It's already pumping, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, and they brought out the story that they don't have the engineering plans to shut it down or turn the switch off if they need it to.
No, I believe that, too.
Well, that's what I'm saying. These guys are talking about, you know, tapping oil for as long as they can sell it, which won't be for all that long. You know, whether or not there's a lot of it or not, the cost is too great. And, you know, just like any other corporation, they can abandon it. People are talking about BP, you know, if things get to be too annoying for them in terms of fines and stuff, they'll just Chapter 11 and say, all right, you guys go take care of it.
Yep. You know, and there go all their liabilities.
And there Tony can stay on his yacht, and, you know, the British pensioners won't have to lose all their assets and their pension funds because of all Chapter 11. But, you know, we don't need to do that. Like, we have, we're putting together a distillery manufacturing company right now, and we're getting people like Joel from, Todd from Colorado, who sold his Exxon stock to buy our stock. Because, you know, the future is not in oil. The future is in the sun. And that's what alcohol is all about. It's liquid solar energy. And, you know, until the sun burns out, we got a good thing going when we use solar energy.
Okay, text message in from John from Mississippi. Can all kinds of cars be converted to run on alcohol fuel?
Well, basically, all cars did run on alcohol fuel before we invented gasoline. And so, yes, all cars can be converted to alcohol, and we can convert diesel engines to run on alcohol, and some places like in Sweden have had diesel engines running on alcohol for 30 years in city buses. So none of this is new technology, but it's technology you don't get to hear much about. Now, BP, they're a big culprit in this because they put up the biggest grant ever in the American education system to UC Berkeley to study biofuels, in other words, alcohol and stuff like that.
Yeah.
$500 million. But it's a very unusual grant. In other words, they own all the patents that come out of the research, and they determine what gets published and what doesn't. So the whole purpose of this BP funding was to bottle up alcohol, biodiesel, and other things like it so that it doesn't compete with BP. If they can get to the patents first, they own them. BP recently banned me from a conference in Mexico and about 100 other scientists who were interested in a desert plant, plain old agave, that makes tequila. And BP is looking, you know, is seeing that people are starting to grow a lot of agave in the deserts because it's a good crop, produces over 1,000 gallons of alcohol per acre, per year. And
is that good?
It's Well, yeah, corn's only 250, and corn needs fertilizer and water and all this other stuff. So, you know, the thing about it was BP put up the money for the conference and then said, nope, it's a private conference now. It's not open to the public, and we say who gets to come and who doesn't, and I was bumped. So, you know, I myself have to run into seeing BP doing everything it can to keep alcohol from interfering with its business.
Okay, next up we go to Don in Waterford, California, west of the Rockies. Good morning, Don. Go ahead.
Hi. Great talk to you, George.
Thanks.
And what's your friend's name?
That's David.
David.
Hi there.
Listen, David, my sister, my baby sister, she is a top speaker for the alternative fuel measures. And she goes all over the country talking about this stuff. And she's going to be at a conference with the president. And she's going to be the top speaker there.
Wonderful.
What's she going to tell him?
Oh, she goes everywhere talking about alternative fuels.
Well, you have her give George or I a call, and we'll send her an alcohol can be a gas book so that she can look into that before she goes to her conference.
Well, she knows all about it. She's been into this for years.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, let's hope they listen to her because, you know, this government has been so afraid of the oil companies that it really needs some, you know, some backbone. And I hope she goes and encourages this government to say, you know, we're going to stand up to these oil companies and we're not going to apologize to them like that Senator Barton who went and said, oh, we're so sorry, BP, that our president has gone nuts on you and is trying to get you to pay for this. You know, we know it was just an accident. It's like, we don't need to apologize to these people.
No, not at all.
We need to tell them what the law is.
People have been damaged. People have been harmed. They should pay.
Absolutely. And, you know, I hope she goes and tells them that and that there is an alternative. They don't have to put up with it.
I wonder how much, though, their insurance companies are paying.
Oh, they're self-insured.
Oh, they are?
Oh, yeah. You know, when BP, you know, well, BP basically said, oh, we don't need these blowout preventers, and we have this liability cap of $75 million. So, you know, we don't need insurance. We're covered. And so they don't have insurance.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
They could have had business interruption insurance. They could have had everything.
Yeah. You know, you know, they've been trying to even shut down contests like ours. We have a rename BP contest. You know, we think that, you know, these guys ought to be called something like the billionaire pirates or the bodacious polluters. And they've been, and you know, they've been shutting down these all over the country.
Bad people.
Bad people. But George, you're going to love this. We bought the renamed BP URLs before they got into shutting everyone down. So before they shut us down, go to our website, or you can just go to rename BP, all one word, and take a look at what we have on the website that has all these great names that people have been sending us, like, you know, like Bitter Pill and these, you know, bodacious prevaricators, these liars told our government that blowout possibilities were too small.
Let's grab Joe in Toronto before we lose him. Go ahead, Joe.
Go, Joe.
Good morning. My buddy, he's Iranian, living in Canada now. He told me that years ago there was a leak in Russia, and what they did to stop the leak was to go with a nuclear device.
They nuked it, exactly.
Underneath the plate so deep that it just sealed it right up, and they had never had a problem after that.
Well, if that happened, and it is possible.
They did do that. They did do that.
They were very lucky. They were very lucky. Have you ever seen a picture of a ground test in the United States where they go down a couple of miles and set one off?
It's not
pretty. And you watch the ground at the surface heave up several hundred feet.
And then drop.
And then drop. And so all that rock above the explosion was all fluidized right up to the surface. And, of course, if you did that in the case of this many thousand PSI deposit that BP has hit, all of it would come right up through all that perforated rock. So, you know, maybe they'd get away with it, but can you really take a chance?
That's the problem, David. Thank you so much. David's websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. When I come right back, Stephen Quayle joins us. We'll talk a little bit about world conflicts, and then we get into Bigfoot and giants with Stephen on Coast to Coast AM.